Computers and smartphones and tablets and other technology, certainly a part of my life, and I bet yours as well. And the fact that today is known as Cyber Monday because of all the online shopping going on, certainly proof of that. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Since just about everyone on your holiday list uses technology in one way or another, we're going to get some good tech gift ideas from Paul Hedges. Paul, for many years, he was the Information Technology Director at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He's now the Emerging Technologies Archivist in the Society's Library and Archives Division, works on digital and audiovisual collections and projects, and been with us a number of times now. And Paul, great to have you back.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Appreciate it very much. Well, you know, Cyber Monday, lots of people are online. I haven't gone online myself yet just to sort of kick the tires and see what's out there, but I know a lot of people are. What are some good tech gift ideas for people on a holiday gift list?
You know, I think it depends on the age group and who is who you're buying for, but we see a wide range of things out there today. I think everything from stocking stuffers to replacing desktop computers, laptops, etc. You know, I think, for me right now, I have older parents. I have mid-20s sons. And so when I look at things for them, and I have nieces and nephews who are in their early teens, you know, for the kids, it usually might be a game for their Xbox or that
their
type
Wii
of thing,
or
their
yeah.
Wii, their PS4. My older boys, more into other types of games, but also devices, etc. I think for stocking stuffers, flash drives, I think...
Earbuds, maybe?
Earbuds. One of the things that we always run out of, it seems, is just charging cables for a variety of devices.
Uh-huh.
So a stocking stuffer for that would be good. But otherwise, you know, I think... there's the big things. Certainly, I think we'll probably skip TVs today, but laptops, tablets. It's been an interesting year to see tablets start to kind of come into the forefront, especially with the Android tablets as well as the Mac and the Windows. So we're seeing a lot more possibilities there.
Lots of things to think about there. And you can join in, too, by the way, with your questions or comments, talking about archiving data and tech holiday gifts a bit with our guest, Paul Hedges. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show. You can go right there and post a question or a comment. And talk with us, maybe. What's going on with your computer? What do you need Paul's advice on? Love to hear from you. Joanne in Lac des Flambeaux, we turn to you first. Joanne, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, hello. My question is probably not with what you're talking about today, but I was wondering if your guest knew of a website where you could find people's cell phone numbers?
That's a great question, and I do not know of any specifically.
You can buy. There are a lot of ones. A lot of them that will, for a price, sell you a number. But
and you know, I would imagine that there are some certain directory websites, but for the most part, cell numbers have not really been added to any standard directories. So, yeah, you know, I.
Can't help you out there.
I really, really can't. But we'll continue to look around, and maybe we can post that online later.
Yeah, we can. And somebody else may have an idea, too.
Yes, we'd love to hear that.
And if you do, give us a call. So stay listening, Joanne, and we'll come back with something here, I bet. Anything. Amy and Abrams, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi, I'm calling. I have a question about they have all these new things for streaming Netflix and Hulu and other things like Comcast for Chrome and
Yeah.
What was the other one? Roku?
Mm-hmm.
Roku.
The Amazon Fire, etc. Yeah, those, it's a great question because it's, there's so many different options there. So historically, what we've seen is DVD drives became internet-enabled, and so you could still purchase a DVD or a Blu-ray player that had built-in Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu Plus streaming. It really comes down to what services that you want to be able to use, and I think your price range. Typically, what I have found is that the DVD players struggle a little bit because they're just not as updatable. Whereas the Roku, the Chromecast you mentioned, some of the other boxes that are dedicated to internet streaming tend to be updated more frequently. They tend to be better supported. So I would lean towards that. The other is that some of those services, you may, like the Roku, I believe, has a wider range of services that it supports.
Yeah.
Chromecast is relatively new. The Amazon Fire, I have not actually read on that product, but my guess is they will focus on Amazon Prime as their primary streaming service, and maybe not Hulu or Netflix. Typically, what they do is they connect to your local internet. That could be wirelessly or with a wire. And then it connects to either your HDMI or some other connection on the back of your television. So you'll need, ideally, a newer TV that has multiple inputs and, of course, you know, HD quality if you want that.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks, Amy. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments as we talk archiving data, tech holiday gifts, computer issues with our guest today, Paul Hedges. Great to have him along. And again, thank you for listening in. You know, this time of the year, you know, we're in December, and here we are. End of year archiving, I think, becomes, you know, there's a lot of things that this time of year, okay, well, maybe I'm just going to save this now. Or let's talk a little bit about saving some of those different types of files.
Sure. Well, I think one of the things that we see often is at the end of the year, people are kind of reflecting back on their year and also thinking about the next. And so often what people ask me about is things such as, well, so I've come to the end of the year and I have thousands of digital pictures. I've got all of this video. What should I do with it? I also like to remind people that at the end of the year is a good time to think about how are you backing up your computer? What kind of services are available for that as well? So typically, we'd just like to remind people that at the end of the year, if they're thinking about that, to sit down and reflect on, you know, kind of go over their images, their digital photos, take a look at what they have on their phone, for example. You showed me just earlier a picture on your phone. And how do we make sure that if you want to keep that picture that you actually have put it someplace that you know you can get at later? So
And with a phone, they eat up a lot of space.
They certainly do. And so setting some time to sit down and connect your phone and to take those images off of your phone and put it onto your computer, but then also weeding. I think one of the things that that is so easy for us to do is to take hundreds, thousands of pictures and never actually go back and do any kind of weeding. So what we do actually in the archives is actually we spend time selecting those things that we want to keep and those things that are going to go away. They may be duplicates. They may be blurry photos. They may be completely unknown, but to first select those things and to let yourself let those other ones go away and be deleted. And
yeah.
That can be a challenge for people. But definitely at the end of the year, it's good to just get through that material and select the things you want, get rid of the rest, and only spend your time preserving or keeping those things you really care about.
And as I look at photos of, for example, Emily, my daughter, I will have the same picture taken 5-6 times in a row and just going through and say, you know what, I don't need the same image and 5 or 6 times and eliminate all but one or maybe two.
Exactly. And then once you've done that selection, then deciding where you're going to put those images. There's a variety of backup services, online cloud services. Purchase an external hard drive, connect it to your computer, and make sure that you have copies. But first, kind of, you've got to really weed through that material, get it down to a manageable amount, and then put it someplace that's safe. And also recognize that if you're going to put it on to a CD or something like that, that typically those CDs are going to die and become unusable within 10 years and if not sooner. So to think about what is your long-term strategy for keeping that around.
You know, it really is interesting because going through some old photos from, we have photos that go back 60 years or 70 years, photos, and I'm often wonder, I have a lot of great images that are not, I don't think are ever going to make it onto a paper.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And so you want to make sure you put those someplace.
Yeah.
Sometimes actually printing can help make sure that those will stay around, but definitely you want to make sure that those digital files are cared for.
Yeah. So. Paul Hedges is our guest today. He is the Emerging Technologies Archivist in the Society's Wisconsin Historical Society's Library and Archives Division. He also consults with small businesses, nonprofits, and churches to help them plan for and manage their websites. Great to have him along. Questions for him or comments, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page. That title is The Larry Mehler Show, and we'd love to hear from you one way or another. I'm Larry Mehler. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in as we talk with Paul Hedges today about archiving data, tech holiday gifts, and a whole lot more. Join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. You've done a lot of looking at a variety of things. Tablets, one area. I know digital photo. We were just talking about photos. Digital photo frames are kind of fun and interesting.
Yeah. In fact, we purchased one for my mother, who is out in California. And what we do, she doesn't have wireless where she's living, but you can get photo frames now that connect wirelessly, and then all the family members can actually upload images to a single location, and then they show up on that photo frame automatically. What we do is I send a little SD card out to her in the mail periodically, and she puts it in, and all of a sudden she has a whole new set of photos, and she tells me regularly that it's set to turn on at about 7:30 in the morning and turns off at 8 p.m. and she just it kind of helps her as an alarm clock. It wakes her up in the morning, and then there's her family, so she really loves that. And those photo frames prices can be anywhere from $30 to a small 8-inch frame to $300 to more of a 13 or 15 inch frame with all the bells and whistles. But they're a nice way, especially if you do have lots of pictures and you'd like to hand them over to a family member or somebody. And of course, businesses use them all the time. I've seen them in businesses. But those are continue to improve and are pretty popular.
Camille in Colfax, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Hope everybody's keeping warm there.
We are trying.
Thanks.
I just have a question. We have really slow telephone internet service right now, and we live in by Eau Claire, Wisconsin, real hilly up here, so we are having trouble getting internet service that's fast enough for our needs. And we don't know anybody that's ever had the satellite service, and was wondering if you knew anything about that. Have people been satisfied with that, or...
It's a good question. So my first question for you is when you say dial up, or your phone service, are you using DSL through your phone service? Okay.
Yes.
So you're not actually using the old dial up where
No.
So that's good. So at least you have DSL, but is it slow or just unreliable?
Just slow.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, so and, if there's more than two people on at a time, it gets even slower.
Oh, my. So definitely satellite internet service can be good speeds. It's not going to compare to the higher speed DSL and Comcast, but it can definitely get you a good internet speed. The key issues, of course, with satellite are always the line of sight. The satellite needs to be able to have a clear line of sight. So depending on how hilly it is around you,
we've had the television service.
Oh, okay.
Before, so we've been satisfied with that for the most part. But we were wondering, if snow gets built up on it, thunderstorms come through, will that be affected on your internet service?
My understanding is that yes, just like your TV service will be affected by those types of things. It essentially is using the same type of sharing of information between your antenna and the satellite as you do with your TV service. It's just that they're putting basically data into that packet from the satellite instead of a TV signal. So it definitely it could be faster, but a couple of things to check. One is to verify your DSL speed. There are a variety of DSL speed check websites, and I don't have any addresses off the top of my head, but if you check those sites, they can tell you what is actually the speed of your DSL that's coming into your house. That's number one. And then number two is that if more than one person is on at a time and you're seeing a big slowdown, is to check maybe internally, make sure that you have newer routers or whoever set up your DSL has given you the latest equipment. That can affect it as well. But I would start by actually verifying what is the speed of the DSL that's coming into your house. And you can typically do that with various DSL speed checker websites that are out there. So I'd try that and then compare the speed that's coming in to the speed that the satellite provider says they can provide. So if the satellite provider says they can provide 768K speeds and you're coming in, your DSL is at 1.1 megabytes, they're not going to be able to help you with a faster signal. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yep. Yeah. Cool. Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much for the help.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Got a Facebook question from Cindy. I'd like to get a device that I can travel with to check my bank accounts, hotel availability, emails, that sort of thing. I have a Samsung Galaxy 5 phone, but it's pretty small for real searching. I have computer at home, now hardwired. My granddaughter suggested a Chrome tablet. What would you suggest? And tablets are one thing you've taken a look at too, Paul.
Yes. Yeah, it's a great question because there's so much variety out there right now. And it is really important to understand what you want to use this device for. If a actual cell phone is too small, then if a tablet is going to help, I think one of the first questions is what kind of connectivity you're going to want. You can get larger tablets with essentially a phone, not a phone plan, but an LTE data plan. Or you can get it with just wireless. And so the question becomes, if you're going to be traveling, then probably wireless is okay. A data plan may be too expensive. But from the fact that you're already familiar with the Android operating system, which is what's on the Galaxy 5, then you may want to look actually for a Android-based tablet.
Sure.
That way you're not looking, you're not, for example, getting maybe an iPad and needing to learn about that, or a Windows tablet that might do that. So what I would suggest is looking at the Android. You're already using a Samsung Galaxy 5. Samsung makes some tablets. So does Google. Has the Google Nexus. But I would suggest sticking with the Android since it's something you already know. Going with something that just has Wi-Fi. You probably do not need something for the data plan. And moving up to something larger, if the phone is too small for you, then really that's your next step.
Yeah, there we go. I think really good advice. Thanks a lot for that Facebook question. Connie in Madison with us next. Hi, Connie. Thanks for calling.
Back to televisions for a moment. I wanted to cut the cable company, because I mostly only watch public television, and I upgraded my internet so that I had a much faster kind of internet. So a friend recommended something called the Mohu Leaf, LEAF, like leaves on a tree, antenna for, I think, under $50. That antenna, which just leans up against the wall of my house with a more modern television, has pulled in such a remarkable number of stations and so clearly that I'm extremely impressed. So it's not your granddaddy's antenna, rabbit ears antennas anymore. It's inside the house. It's incredibly low profile. It looks like a sheet of paper, except it's dark. It's a dark color, and it does a wonderful job. So for an inexpensive gift for somebody who wants to cut their TV cable connection, this might be an idea to pull in broadcast television.
I think that's a great idea. So I'm assuming that this is pulling in HD or standard definition TV signals?
Yes.
Yeah. That's well.
And I'm getting what I want to watch, and I'm not bothered by all the things that they're constantly marketing to me that I don't watch anyway.
Yeah.
And through my internet connection, I do have a Roku box now, and I can watch backlogged public television and a variety of other things, some of them subscription like Netflix and so on, but others just there. And I'm really pleased. It's like a new age in television for me, and quite satisfactory.
That's great. Yeah. And it was like $30, you said, Connie?
Between $30 and $50, and I got it, it's widely available. The company's name is Mohu.
Yeah.
Mohu.
Yeah.
And I'm quite pleased. There might be other kinds of antennas that use a similar technology, but this was the one I chose, and it really was recommended, and it's really worked magnificently.
Boy, thanks for that.
Yeah, I think it's a great alternative for people who essentially have moved to a streaming only service, but still want to get local channels, and glad that local channels are still being broadcast over the air. So this is a great alternative.
Yeah, thank you, Connie.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate it very much. You might have sold
a few antennas this morning. Who knows? Thanks again. By the way, you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. Doug in Green Bay, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest could tell us what he recommends for people who are on the road with RVs, where you stop anywhere at any who knows when, and you may be looking for cable news channels, or you might be want to get on the internet. What do you recommend for that type of setup?
You're living my dream. Yeah. So it's a really great question, and I think it's really going to depend on what you want to be able to do when you stop. Certainly, these days you could, with a tablet or a computer, you could, as long as you have a reliable internet connection, you would be able to access any kind of streaming content that you're looking for. But at the same time, you will not be able to get likely any local TV channels unless you added some form of additional TV viewing capability to that device. I would suggest that you're going to get the most out of essentially either a laptop or a desktop computer as far as being able to do more than just streaming. If you're going to be writing emails or doing other types of things, if you're going to be taking lots of pictures and you need to download those pictures to an external hard drive or something like that, at least having a laptop while you're traveling is going to give you the most flexibility there. If you can afford multiple devices, then a laptop and some form of phone / tablet could be helpful. Clearly, we all need a phone when we travel. The new iPhone 6 Plus, which is an interesting size. It's larger than the smaller phones, but is large enough and also is a phone, so that could be an option. But it, you know, these days you could get, for right now, you could get a laptop easily within the range of $400 for the lowest end to something, of course, much higher, but probably a reasonable range would be about $800 to $1,200 would be a decent laptop to travel with and have adequate storage and power for some time, and then look for kind of a phone / a tablet device. I think would be good for that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't take a TV on the road personally. I would be able to get everything, I think, from those two devices. Mm-hmm.
If a television was available, maybe one of those Mohu Leafs.
There you go. There you go. Yeah.
If you've already got one in your RV, that would be a.
Yeah, and I think if you're looking for local content,
right,
wherever you are, that would definitely be a good way to go.
Thanks, Doug. Tony in Wanakee. Hello.
Hi. I was just going to add some about the Mohu Leaf. I tried a couple different antennas. Actually, four, and the Mohu Leaf also has an amplified version, and it is just unbelievable what it pulls in.
Wow, that's great!
It's about $20 more than the regular one, and I can't say enough about it. It's well designed, well engineered. And it works as advertised.
And I'm definitely going to look into it because I just had this conversation with my wife the other day, which was, you know, do we really need all of those cable channels? So thanks. I really appreciate you guys sharing this information.
Yeah, appreciate it.
You can also buy an antenna amplifier at an electronics store, say Radio Shack, and just hook it up to a Mohu Leaf. But the Mohu Leaf amplified is just a little bit better built in.
Great.
Thank you very much, Tony. Mohu Leaf Amplified. There we go. Ed in Lodi. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the problem I'm having with my laptop. Two of the USB ports do not work, and I continuously get this message on the screen. It says USB device not recognized. One of the USB devices attached to this computer has malfunctioned, and Windows does not recognize it. For instance, in solving this problem, click this message. Well, I have tried many, many ways to get rid of this message and to get those USB ports operational again, all to no avail. Do you have any suggestions?
So a couple of places to start. One would be how long has this been going on?
About 4 months.
Okay. Typically, there are a couple of ways that reasons why this could be occurring. One, it could simply be a hardware failure, but usually the problem is about drivers and the software itself. So there are a couple of ways to approach that. One would be to go back and do a restore of a previous save point on your computer. And what that does is, for example, it's possible that something was installed that corrupted the drivers. And by going back to a previous save state on your operating system, it can basically remove that software and restore those drivers. Since it's been 4 months, it's possible that you may have done a lot of things on your computer that you don't want to have uninstalled. So the other option would be to run a variety of, what I would suggest, frankly, is if the device, if you don't feel that it's a hardware problem, would be a complete rebuild of the operating system. I know that's a little bit of a nuclear option, but if you can back up all of your data, and if you still have the ability to reinstall, is this Windows on the device?
Yes, it's Windows 7.
Okay, if you can reinstall Windows 7, that should be able to get you. That would at least rule out the possibility that is actually a driver issue. Another possible way to go would be to go into your drivers. There's a place in Windows where you can see drivers, see all of the devices, and you can go to that USB entry and in that list of devices, and you can uninstall the driver and reinstall it. That possibly could help as well. I'm not recognizing myself the error message. I'm not familiar with it, but I would start with the drivers first. And if you're still getting the error, then asking somebody to actually look at the hardware.
Yeah, there we go.
I've tried to uninstall the drivers and reinstall them, and that doesn't work. Do you think that I could go to the manufacturer of the laptop and ask for the original drivers for the USB devices?
You probably could. I would suggest going to the website, to their support site, and looking for those drivers. But in the end, it probably would be quicker to just reinstall Windows 7 completely reinstall the operating system. Don't install any other software. Test your USB drive. And if it works, then you know that there was some other software that was installed that had corrupted those drivers.
There you go. Good luck, Ed. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. The next caller is Jim in Cambridge. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
I have a comment for the people that are looking for television on the road.
Yep.
Okay.
The product that they're looking for is called the Tailgater, and it's a satellite dish that basically anywhere you go, you just drop the thing on the ground, it orients itself to the satellite, hooks up, connects, and then you can watch HD quality television through a dish network satellite package. It's real simple.
Yeah, sounds great.
Whoa.
And does it work with specific satellite companies? Is it direct or how does?
Well, I'm looking at one right now that's on the Dish website.
Dish, okay.
But my parents have it, use it for everything. They're snowbirds, and they use it. It's called the Tailgater. That's all I know it as.
That's great.
Wow, that sounds great. Thank you.
Yep, bye.
Bye. Appreciate the call. The Tailgater. I should have asked him about how much they cost.
It looks like it's on the Dish website, he said.
Oh, yeah, sure. We just go to the Dish website. And Andrew in Warrens, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's on your mind?
Well, I was calling about that young lady who was wanting to find about the internet data via satellite. The down around Warrens, I looked into it. They said the max you can get is a 1 megabyte signal if you live rurally. And as for the satellite versus a cell phone internet, you might as well go with some kind of cell phone Wi-Fi hotspot device because it's going to be a more reliable signal, and the packages cost just about the same, and you got about the same limit. And as for the other guy was talking about the TV thing, it's about $350 to buy the antenna he was talking about. And if you go through Dish, it's $50 a month for the TV service.
Oh, excellent. Very quick advice. Thanks, Andrew, for that information. Boy, that was fast service. Thank you so much. Appreciate it very much. Caller Kevin from Tomahawk will be going on a cruise and wants to be able to pass the time reading, watching movies, and playing games. He doesn't like sunning himself like his wife does, so he wonders if a tablet would fill all of those needs.
I think it certainly can. My understanding is on a cruise, typically internet connectivity is either not possible or it's overly expensive. I don't have experience with cruises, so I'm not sure about that. So if we start with the assumption that you're going to fill up your tablet with all of the things you need, then certainly an iPad or an Android tablet that has already loaded that information on there. You can certainly put lots of ebooks. You can put several movies. Movies are going to take a lot more space, so that you probably put less on the device. But you could definitely
put them on a jump drive somehow.
You could, well, and see, I think that is an interesting problem, is that the iPad does not support USB. The Android devices are spotty. Now, of course, there's the Microsoft Surface devices, which are Windows devices that are more of a tablet, and they have USB connections and have those options. So I think it depends on what you want to kind of pack up into your tablet device and take with you, and how much you plan to take. My guess is you could definitely do this no problem with ebooks, but if you want to take 10 or 15 movies, then probably an iPad would not be able to help you with that.
Talking with Paul Hedges today, he is now the Emerging Technologies Archivist in the Society's, the Historical Society's Archives Division, works on digital and audiovisual collections and projects. He's our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, taking a look at your computer today and archiving data and tech holiday gifts with our guest, Paul Hedges. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Call us at 800-642-1234 with your question. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. And Greg in Menominee, Michigan has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Greg.
Good morning. Good morning, Larry and Paul. I appreciate your taking the call. I got something that's a little maybe off of what he does, but I've got an iPad 2. And up till now, it's been perfect. Boom, boom, boom. You just tap her. But ever since Steve's gone, you know, he demanded perfection. They went to this operating system of 8, and bang, it's so slow you'd think it was regular Windows. I'm disgusted with it. I can't do it. And I'm just wondering, is there a way to go back to like 7, you know, any of the 7s or even 6s as far as the operating system?
So first question would be, did you do the update through using the iTunes app?
Yeah.
On your computer,
yeah, just,
okay. And so when you plug your iPad in, you should see a revert to a backup option in iTunes. Have you
really?
So
I haven't seen that.
Okay, so take a look there. Typically when you do an upgrade like that, you can you can use iTunes to basically
revert
or basically, you know, go back to a previous backup that was there. What I would suggest is and I don't have internet access with me right now, but would be to search, do a web search for, you know, restore previous OS for iPad 2 and see what kind of options come up.
That sounds like it'd be worth it.
I totally understand your frustration there. Definitely the older iPads have struggled with the iOS 8 update. Even new devices, they've had to put out some minor updates to deal with some problems. But I would suggest looking first in iTunes. When you connect the device, look in iTunes where it shows you the page, you know, kind of the general information page about your iPad. There should be a restore to a previous backup option right there on that page.
There we go. Good luck, Greg. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had a Facebook question from Adam, who is wondering what's the best printer to get for wireless printing from an iPhone 4. Needs to be AirPrint enabled. It is for home use, printing from web pages, emails, and a few photos. What would you suggest?
That's a good question. And I'm not sure I'm going to be very helpful on this one. Certainly, any wireless printer these days will likely be supported. My understanding is AirPrint itself is typically device specific. So what I would do if I was in this situation, I would start by doing some searching for AirPrint enabled printers, look at the vendors and the price ranges. If you don't need to print photos, you're going to probably find something fairly inexpensive. But I'll admit, I'm not very familiar with AirPrint, so
okay.
I don't think I can help there.
All right, and then an email from Jim. My mother passed away recently, and going through her things,
Found many, many photos, boxes of them, more than I even imagined, and some going back many generations, and some people not always identified. Trying to think of how and who should keep these photos, and then how to potentially share them with close and potentially distant relatives.
Well, that's definitely right up my alley. We've done that in our family several times. And the first thing to do is to essentially, get familiar with what's there. And if you're, do some initial weeding, essentially go through the material and clearly if there are duplicates and those types of things, feel comfortable removing those. If there are certain events that are reflected in those photos that you think others in your family will know about, then maybe having a little group get together to go through those can be helpful. But I'll give you a personal example. Sitting down with my mother several years ago, we were going through photos and slides, and even she, who took those photos, she looked at some and said, well, this is the picture of a mountain where we were at. I have no idea about what this mountain was. We said, okay, let's, we can eliminate that. There's no artistic value. There's no memory value in that. Once you've weeded this down, then, of course, the question is, how do you make it accessible to other people? A couple of rules, generally. One is I am not a big fan of taking original images and then cutting them up and putting them into scrapbooks. I always tell people to take a scan of that original photo and then print that and put that into a scrapbook, which can be helpful for sharing. But ultimately, if you want to share these remaining images that you've decided to keep with as many people as possible, then typically scanning those, there are plenty of services you can send them to these days where they will scan those photos or you can scan them. And then putting them on to DVDs, and I mean DVDs as storage, not as a video, or other kinds of storage devices, or even online, and sharing it with as many people as possible, and asking for people to maybe comment or to help describe them. But the more copies, the better. When it comes to digital, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But you will need to. One way to start, if you're overwhelmed, is to essentially select those that you definitely know are who the people are and the most important images. Scan those first, leave the other ones still in print, and then share just those selected photos.
Yeah.
But definitely get out there and share them.
Kevin in Cuba City, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have an issue with my Yahoo page. The search engine does not do any search. And then with my email, I can receive emails, but it will not let me compose.
Okay, a couple questions. What browser are you using?
It's IE9.
Okay. Have you been having any issues with pop-ups or things not going where you want them to go?
Nope.
Okay.
I got 3 accounts on the computer, and the Yahoo works on all those, except for it does not work on my administrator.
Okay.
It just, quit working one day.
Well, so the first thing typically we would look at to try to solve that would be what type of software may have been installed that might be conflicting. Is there a toolbar that was accidentally installed? Was there some other kind of malware or other type of unwanted software that may have been installed? That
yeah.
Have you been? Have you looked at that?
I went on my computer there to see if anything was put on here without my recollection, you know. And I didn't see anything recently put on there, you know.
Okay. Said yeah, it's a really interesting.
Did you yourself put anything on?
No.
No, that was the other thing because, you might have, if you put something on, sometimes that could even interfere.
Yeah, no, I haven't done. This computer's actually kind of old. It's an old Vista, but I've never had an issue with it.
Here's
like the day I got it.
Yeah, so here's one possible way to check this would be to I would suggest Chrome over Firefox at the moment, but one would be to install the Chrome browser. And if you feel more comfortable with Firefox, either one of those would be separate browsers, and then go into Yahoo email and see if you're able to do the things you want it to do. If it does, then clearly there's something that is interacting with Internet Explorer in that specific profile on the computer that is creating the problem. There are likely ways to do some cleanup of that, but what you still need to do is try to get to the bottom of whether or not it's a bigger problem than Internet Explorer itself. So try Firefox or Chrome, install those, go into Yahoo email, give that a try. If that's working well, then actually either one of those is much better.
Talking with Paul Hedges, he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be right back with Paul. Stay with us. Computers and all the gadgets that we rely on to connect with the world through the Internet have become a part of our daily lives at home and at work. They can be great tools until they're not working, and then you're kind of stuck. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. For many years, Paul Hedges was the Information Technology Director at Wisconsin Historical Society. He's now the Emerging Technologies Archivist in the Society's Library and Archives Division. He works on digital and audiovisual collections and projects. And with us until 12:30 today. And again, Paul, thank you for spending time with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been fun.
We have open lines for you. Maybe you have a tech gift that you're hoping to get this holiday season. What is it? Or maybe you'd like to buy one for a loved one. Paul has some advice, I think, to share on gifts that might fit your budget. And maybe you've got an issue with your computer. What do you need Paul's advice on? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And we would certainly love to hear from you. So please do that, and we'll see what we can do. Listener Shelley wonders if you can still buy new computers that come with the Windows 7 operating system. A lot of people like that system.
Yes, and actually you can with some caveats. So Microsoft is phasing out Windows 7. In January, they will be announcing Windows 10, which is still a little confusing to some of us that they're jumping from 8 to 10, but, that's, I'm sure, a marketing thing. But Windows 7 is still available, and so here are the rules on that. Essentially, Microsoft said you can still make Windows 7 available as long as it's Windows 7 Pro, not the home version. Which is fine. It's Windows 7 Pro works as well as home and better. It has some nice additional capabilities, but typically, and if you're struggling to find a new computer with Windows 7, what I always suggest, I suggest this for anybody, is to always go to the business site of that company. So, for example, if you go to HP or a Dell or an Acer, etc., if they have a business unit, a business part of their store, you will more likely find computers, new computers with Windows 7 Pro, and you'll also find those computers without a lot of extra cruddy software, I'll say, that has been added to it. So essentially, you'll get a good, stable Windows 7 Pro brand new computer by going essentially to any of these, to Dell or to the big companies, and asking for and going into their business section. You can also typically in the stores, at least they'll show you a list on the left of which laptops or desktops have Windows 7 Pro mm-hmm. available. But it's definitely still available there.
Isn't there a way, I'm trying to remember hearing something about it, a way to make Windows 8 work like 7?
Yes and no. I mean, Windows 8 introduced this new tile interface, and definitely 8.1 reintroduced the start menu and stepped back. My understanding is Windows 10 will take another step back to kind of the comfort level of the Windows 7 interface, but also still make the tiles and the various apps available to you. But yes, definitely if you have a Windows 8 computer, you can make that tile screen to be less new, less confusing.
Yeah. Dan in Black River Falls up next. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's go to Ernie in Rhinelander. I'm sorry. Dan, we'll get to you right after Ernie. Ernie, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. We're looking for antenna, HD antenna, that's amplified. And I've been on the internet looking at these antennas, and there's one out there that will do 150-mile range. And I just wanted to know if you guys know anything about any other antennas.
Well, actually, I didn't until today. We continue to hear from several people, I'm assuming, about this Mohu Leaf, I don't know what its range is, but it appears to be very popular with the listeners today. So definitely look for the Mohu Leaf. It's spelled M-O-H-U and then Leaf, like the leave, L-E-A-F. And
they have an amplified version.
And they do have an amplified version, and see what their range would be.
Okay, thank you much.
Yeah, yep. Well, good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. And now we will turn to Dan in Black River Falls. Dan, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hello, how are you guys doing?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Good. Thanks for having me. I just ordered a new laptop, and I'm just wondering what a good brand of security and antivirus I can get for it.
At times this becomes more of a personal preference than anything. I'm a big fan of reminding people that usually it's behaviors, it's not being aware of how search works and where viruses typically show up that is the most important. But if you have a Windows laptop, one of the places to start for free is essentially just the Windows protection. It is free. It gets updated regularly. Other than that, you could, I'm familiar with McAfee and certainly some of the others. And at that point, it just becomes a preference. They all typically do the same types of things. They typically run about the same. What I have found is that if you're looking for free, the built-in Windows antivirus works very well. It manages most of the things that come in. I also no longer use Internet Explorer. I use Chrome. Excuse me. I use Chrome as my browser because it has better malware protection. So it's those types of things that are probably going to keep you safer.
There we go.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Jim in Libertyville, Illinois, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Paul. Thanks for taking my question. I enjoy your shows all the time, Larry.
Thank you.
And I wanted to ask you, ask Paul about converting 35-millimeter slides to digital format. I know there are several different little machines, scanners, available that will do that job, and I wonder if you have any preferences. I do have a lot of slides. I have 140 slide trays, and I have probably 20 or 25 of those trays.
I do certainly have some suggestions. I'm not a fan of the dedicated 35-millimeter slide digitizer, primarily because I have more than slides that I digitize. So if you have prints, if you have negatives that you want to scan, then what I would suggest is looking for a flatbed scanner that basically allows for scanning of negatives or color slides. Typically, how those work is that they come with so the lid will have a light in it. And so what happens is that you take slides, you put them into a little holder, you put it onto the flatbed, you put the top down on top of it, and light is shown through, and then it scans directly. The model I use scans four at a time. You put four slides in, you run it through, it automatically detects each of the four slides and will save them, and then I take the slides out and put in another four. It moves pretty quickly, and the one I use and it gets really great reviews is an Epson scanner. I think it might be called an Epson Perfection, and it definitely, look for the ones that says it does slides or negatives, that kind of thing.
And what would that run roughly? Is it a few hundred bucks?
Typically, you're going to spend maybe $150, $200 for that scanner.
That's really not all that bad when you think about what it can do.
No, especially a lot of us may have color or old black and white negatives. It does a great job with those. And it scans a high enough resolution so that with the small slides, you'll get a very good quality scan. So I would suggest that over a dedicated device that, because then you have more options.
Okay, very good.
Thanks a lot for going. And which is the device that you yourself use?
It is actually an Epson.
Oh, Epson.
And it's several years old now, but it's an Epson scanner.
Colleen in Milwaukee, turning to you next. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I'm learning really a lot today. I appreciate it. I have a similar question to the gal who emailed about her Windows 7. I had to get a new computer very recently. I had to move quickly. I was trying to find a computer with 7, and I could not find it. I had to get 8.1. My IT fellow for my company suggested that we just remove that and install Windows 7 Pro, which seemed to be a reasonable approach. We did, and now my cursor is going crazy when I'm writing emails. When I'm creating a Word document, it behaves. But it's a wild mouse. And I was wondering, I called Dell, and they said it's because of what we did, that we have corrupted the system, or that they didn't use language that strong. But I was wondering, is that true?
Well, from the manufacturer's perspective, essentially, they're going to blame it on you because you've modified the computer so significantly that, you know, that they're, so that's, I'm not surprised by that response. You know, bottom line, I agree with the IT person. Typically, when you buy an 8.1, a computer with 8.1 on it, you do have some downgrade rights to be able to install Windows 7 Pro on it. That still exists. Why you're having cursor trouble with a specific application, though, is somewhat bizarre. What are you using for your email? Are you using a specific program?
In terms of a browser or...
So are you reading all your email in a browser?
Oh, dear. Now I'm not sure how to answer this. I have Gmail.
Okay.
And I also, my personal account is AOL, and I have problems with both.
Okay.
And I've tried using Internet Explorer, and I've also tried using Firefox, and I have problems with both.
Wow. And only when you're reading your email?
Correct.
Huh. That is very strange and specific. Unfortunately, because of the downgrade, Dell support is likely not to going to provide help. If you can go back to your IT person who helped with the downgrade, maybe he or she could help with that. But I think you'd have to dig a little deeper because it is such a unique error that it's nothing comes to mind.
Go online. I wonder if anybody else has had that. Go to one of the services or the discussion spots.
Yeah, you know, Google search for errors is always a good thing. Just be careful what you click on, but
forums is what the word I was trying to think of.
Yes, but certain kinds of online forums could help. This is a unique issue. I'm not sure how to solve that one.
So a forum with that exact and the most specific, be as specific as you can and on one of the forums, the more specific, the better.
Sure. Searching for Windows 7 Pro, cursor, erratic cursor, reading AOL email, and then searching around and seeing what comes up.
Good luck, Colleen. Thanks for calling. I want to give Tom in Wausau a chance to join us. Tom, hi to you.
Hi, this is Tom. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a lot of mini cassette video camera films that I would like to archive or store. I was putting them on DVD, which was fairly tedious, and those only have a lifespan of about 10 years. But I was wondering if there is a way to put them all on a hard drive, not the computer hard drive, but a separate hard drive, and keep them that way.
So what are the tape formats that you're digitizing from?
I have to tell you that I don't remember offhand. It was like these mini cassettes.
Okay, so they're mini. So they might be
Super
either VHS-C or mini DV, possibly.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, mini DV sounds familiar.
Okay, that makes sense. So there are a couple of things to think about. One is certainly getting the video off of the tape to a digital file is the first step. You did some conversion before. Do you recall what tool you used to do that?
I believe it was a Sony machine that would make DVDs out of them.
I see. Okay. So,
but I don't have them all done. I just have like half of them done.
So there are a couple of approaches. Definitely, and I can provide some suggestions on how to deal with those DVDs as well. But I think the first question is to decide whether or not you're going to do the work yourself or farm it out to somebody else. Either way, what you want as a result of that is a digital file that you can then put onto a hard drive and store. One of the things to consider is that when you create a DVD or when that unit created the DVD, it actually just created a variety of files on that DVD. They're called VOB. If you look, if you actually open the disk and look at it, you'll see a VOB files with the extension VOB and IFO. That is actually just the digital video that has been saved as what's called an MPEG-2 format and converted and put into this format so that it will play back in a DVD player. You could actually copy those files, copy all the files on that DVD to a hard drive, create a folder on a hard drive for that video and copy all those files there. And most Windows or Mac-based video players would play those files back for you. So that if you're looking to get things off of the DVD onto a hard drive, you could do that. You could just create a folder on the hard drive and copy all the files that are in that DVD to the hard drive. And then you can play it back.
So would you connect the hard drive to your computer and then set it up that way?
Yeah, so take your external hard drive, connect it to your computer, take the first DVD that you had converted and put it into your DVD player. Open it like you're opening a disc, not as though you're playing playing the video, and you'll see a video folder and an audio folder and a bunch of files there. Make sure to copy everything that's there to a folder on the external hard drive, and at least you'll have a copy of that DVD on the external hard drive, and then you can play it back. There are also software tools that will let you convert that DVD video to a different video format, maybe an MP4 or something else. So I think the first thing is to get it onto the hard drive and, you know, and off the DVD so as the DVD goes bad, you still can play it.
Okay.
If for those that are still on the tape, you know, I would, if you're going to convert them in-house, you know, buy something to do that work, then I would say convert those all to ideally a Windows AVI format or a QuickTime format. So
I have Mac, so I probably
QuickTime.
If I did want to do it out-house or through some other party, do you have a name of
somebody?
So I don't in Wausau. I know that there are some local companies in Madison, but also I do know that there are some very good reputable firms that are in other states where you can ship them to. Unfortunately, I don't know any off the top of my head, but that's something we could look at. What I would suggest is first looking locally for a local company that does that work.
And you're going to find one in Wausau.
You'll definitely find one in Wausau. Yeah. And then ask them to deliver to you not DVDs, but actual video files. Sometimes they'll be able to put it on a hard drive for you.
There we go. Good luck, Tom. Thank you so much for coming. And Paul, thank you so much. Boy, the time flew. Look forward to another visit from you. I hope you'll have time to do it again with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Paul Hedges with the Wisconsin Historical Society, where he is the emerging technologies archivist, and he'll be back. We'll get him back and do it again. Chef Terry Milligan joins me tomorrow to talk about holiday cooking. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.